like Lieutenant John Wood, Rio 2.
Okay. It was obvious that we were going to have to go on to Ascension Island. Our problem was how we were going to get there. It was decided initially to use Gibraltar. And as we hadn't got diplomatic clearance to use either Spain, which was obviously going to be difficult, or Portugal, with the various islands in the Atlantic. So we went to Gibraltar, waited for a while, and then left. Eventually, when we were cleared, we left Gibraltar very, very heavy to go out for Ascension Island.
That's pretty tight, because the Gibraltar runway is pretty short, isn't it?
It was very tight, very tight. And in fact, we had to ignore the Spanish airspace restriction, which we normally work to, and just fly straight into it, climbing until we had sufficient height to turn. It was quite exciting on the takeoffs, but we moved stuff down to Ascension Island, and then for some time, basically ourselves and the other transport aircraft just loaded Ascension Island up. Eventually we moved to bypass Gibraltar, and we were flying down to Dakar in Senegal, and then through to Ascension Island, unload, and back to Dakar.
But before you used Dakar, you were able to fly non-stop Gibraltar to Ascension Island, were you?
Yes. That's not really a problem. It's about an 8-hour flight, and that's well within the compass of the Hercules. In fact, the same thing applied going down to Dakar, because it's about eight and a half hours to Dakar. And what we tended to do, it was very nice, because we were accommodated in Dakar at one of the Meridian hotels, and we would fly into Dakar, and then Dakar Ascension back to Dakar in the same day, and then wait, and then come north again.
So you slip on at Ascension. On the return.
That's right. But Ascension basically didn't have the accommodation to cope with us. Then
right at the beginning,
yes, that's right. And then Ascension Island was slowly developed to give us more time to work down there. And they rented from the Americans a setup of concertina accommodation, which was air-conditioned, and when we put British beds in there, was actually quite comfortable. Incredibly strange accommodation in its concept. Very good. Very utilitarian. But quite comfortable. And we then started to build up in Ascension Island. But in the meantime, I'd been taken off the transport world to join Wing Commander David Farquhar, who's famous for other reasons, as on the first ever tanker crew when they decided to convert the Hercules to air-to-air refueling. And we, with three other crews, went to Marham to do a very, very abbreviated tanker course. And within 6 weeks, we went from freighters to air refuelers. And we went down to Ascension on long detachments, staying in the concertina city, to fly up and down the Atlantic, tanking various Hercules mainly, to the Falklands for whatever reason.
This was after the June, after the Argentines had been cleared off?
Yes. That's right.
Your customers landed at Stanley.
There was some tanking of aircraft which went to the Falklands, didn't land and came back. Now, the timing of those, you'd really need to check with other sources as to whether they actually went down there when the fighting was on. But it would have been very close. And certainly we ended up tanking the early air bridges. And then as soon as they laid the repaired runway down there, they hired some AM-10 matting off the Americans, which is similar to PSP. But when it's new, it's a lot better. When it's old, it's lethal, because it's basically sheet metal with a surface glued to it, somewhat like sandpaper. When the sandpaper surface wears off, you're literally landing on sheet metal, which is far worse than ice. But we tanked up and down the Atlantic for a long time out of Ascension Island, and then I think it was the very beginning of October, we went in with two tankers to land at Stanley, to operate at Stanley, in support of the Phantoms. And that was quite exciting, because the war had not long ended. The islands were absolutely littered with abandoned armaments. One really could walk along little lanes and paths just outside Stanley, or even Stanley itself, and pick up machine guns, pistols, rifles.
Argentinian weapons.
All Argentinian abandoned stuff, yeah. The danger was, of course, landmines. They were everywhere and anywhere, and they hadn't been recorded. So there was always a danger of going off the beaten track. But we operated there then, given the Phantom's cover. We had interesting accommodation, in that we had a tented village on Stanley Airport, where the standby crews slept, and we had the frame tents made up for a 20-man accommodation with our own ops set up. We were able to make it somewhat more comfortable than others because of our ability to take people flying, so we were doing a little bit of trade-in to get heaters, etc. But every third day, we went to on board the SS Rangatira. It was better known as the Rangatraz, but it was actually a North Sea ferry. And there were several, in fact, the accommodation for a lot of people were, in fact, ferries, which had been commandeered by the government from Sealink, British Rail, the various other lines that crossed the channel. And they were positioned down there, and they were actually very comfortable. The beauty of it for all of us was that once we were on board, we could get a shower, which was the one thing that we could not get on land. The work was very interesting. We flew a lot. The conditions, as with conditions in those sort of theatres everywhere, were Spartan, to say the least. But we were lucky in as much as the mobile catering squadron had set up, and the food that they produced was absolutely out of this world. How the guys produced such magnificent meals with the facilities they had and the supply line that they had, we don't know, but we were always very grateful.
What did they sell
out as an example? Oh, huge roast beefs. Yeah, not small joints, but almost a hindquarter cooked at one time to feed everyone that was there. Mainly British style food, but again, occasionally they would vary it, and pizzas would come out, curries would come out, pasta, and always very, very tasty, very well presented, and obviously not hotel standards, but in the field conditions, very, very good. And always with a tremendous atmosphere. Very friendly, very obliging, not only for the Air Force, because they were catering for everyone at Stanley. And it was a delight to go in to eat. And they worked incredibly hard, and they really do deserve any credit that was being given to them.
And they were on the ground, not on the ship.
They were on the ground.
Makes it all the more remarkable, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, the food on the ships were quite good, but that was obviously civilian catering, often Chinese, because the shipping lines employ a lot of Chinese catering staff. They were good, the food there was good, but it just didn't have the sparkle that the catering people produced on land.
Could you get beers down there and things like that? Or when?
Yes, yeah, there was beer on the ships. There was a couple of local pubs in Stanley where one could go for a drink if one could get to it, very rare, and their stocks were obviously very limited because the numbers of troops was quite high, so it didn't take long to drink them dry. The local people were absolutely fantastic, very friendly. Quite a cultural shock. It was like stepping back 40 years. The cottages, the gardens, the style of life was very much the style of life that I'd grown up with in the Forest of Dean, to the old gates, which were pulled closed by chains with large cogwheels on as closing weights. The vegetable garden up one side of this rickety old path, the flower garden up the other side, or the chickens run up the side of the garden, the washing facilities out in the kind of outhouse, very much 1940s rural England. And it just hadn't changed.
And the mental attitudes were the same, were they?
Very much the same. Slow, lethargic, definitely not dense, typically country.
Suspicious of change.
Yes, very much suspicious of change, didn't want change, very welcoming, very friendly. Again, very, very 1940s rural England.
No thieving?
No crime.
No crime.
People did not close their doors. They had a jail. I don't think they'd had an occupant for some years. If they had, it would probably have been the inevitable for someone who was drunk and put in the cells overnight to quieten down before he was sent home.
Much greater respect for authority, is
there? Yes, because being a small community, their authority was the governor. One or two policemen who were obviously part of the community. And of course they had no real need to kick against authority, because they were all in the same small boat. Very, very pleasant way of living. Not what we would want, but in a lot of ways, I think it's probably what the people who drop out and go and live in wild country areas would be looking at.
Did you just stay in Stanley, or did you meet people right out in the Bondock, so to speak?
We occasionally, if we could, got out as far as Goose Green, but it was very difficult. It meant taking a helicopter ride, and at that stage the helicopters were very busy with more professional things to do than just carry people around on sightseeing tours. We obviously flew all the way around the islands, but we didn't meet that many people, but we did get to know the people in Stanley quite well.
And presumably all the Argentinian prisoners of war had gone before you got there, had they?
Or yes. Yeah, they'd gone.
And what the locals, I mean, what were their reactions to being invaded and so on? Did it affect them a lot?
I think they were all very shocked. They just couldn't understand why anyone would want to upset their very pleasant way of life. They started to change very quickly. Certainly, it was very obvious that the innate intelligence of rural people was coming into play. The amount of shops that were selling souvenirs very, very quickly. The contradictions that went on, shops selling souvenirs and pricing them quite highly because it was the Falklands. The Falkland Islands store, who really did not know the value of their own goods. Sometime after it had quietened down, one could still buy a box of brass screws for 25 pence. The same screws in England were being packaged at 70 pence for three. So there was a great awareness in some respects, great unawareness in others. They also started to change their attitudes. They became less and less welcoming as time went on, as more and more abuses of their friendship occurred with people invading their pubs, the inevitable intoxication, fights, the usual problems of too many people in a small area. They also started to look at the recriminations amongst themselves and others. And also, I think with the sort of money that the troops were taking in, they started to look at themselves more inwardly and at their own circumstances. They all very quickly started to demand more social amenities. And it's quite interesting going back there now, 10, 12 years later, as quite large development of modern housing and modern facilities.
When were you last there?
I was there last year. Just very briefly, but still the change is quite dramatic.
What were their reactions to the invaders? I don't think the Argentinians behaved all that well, did they?
Lots of stories, lots of rumours. Individuals down there will tell, some of the individuals who had Argentinians billeted on them actually had not a lot to say against them. Others did. Others disliked the situation. Some of them had some very unpleasant memories. It depended, I think, again, a great deal on the individuals or the individual groups of Argentinians. Those that behaved well were not welcomed, but they were tolerated. Those that behaved badly were intensely hated.
Going back to your work down there, you were fueling phantoms a lot of the time. I mean, was air refueling necessary to get them off the ground with a full load? I mean, could they actually get out of Stanley with a full load?
Yes, they could.
Full tanks and everything.
Yeah, that wasn't the problem. The problem was that to go right out to the far side of the Falklands from Stanley, it's actually quite a long way. It's virtually the equivalent of flying the full length of Wales. And then to sit out over the sea on a cap. Should they have to go and investigate anything?
Cap being?
Combat Air Patrol. When they had to go investigate something, which was daily, because the Argentinians were playing the brinkmanship game of sending aircraft to the 150-mile limitation and trying to break in as often as they could. Whenever they went up to look at them, they would use fuel at a very, very fast rate. It would have meant that virtually every time they went to look at something, they would have had to gone back to Stanley to refuel, which obviously meant a lot of transit time. It was far more efficient to have a tanker sitting just inside them, normally about 50, 60 miles inside the boundary, with a load of fuel on, so that they could go off, look at whatever they wanted to, come back to the tanker, refill, and then they could immediately take up their patrol again, knowing full well that they could stay there for a long time. And indeed, on certain days when the Argentinians made life very difficult, we often used both tankers, because we had two tankers stationed there at any time, and we'd often use both tankers, the one tanker refueling the other tanker whilst the Phantom was away looking at something else, and then the Phantom would come back and take off the other tanker. And it was basically a way of just moving fuel up the line, and it kept the fighter where it needed to be, close to the edge of the fits.
You were saying earlier on that while the war was still raging, or even before it started properly, planes were actually going down to the Falklands without landing. Were they on mail drops and things like that?
They certainly were. I don't think much mail was dropped down there. Certainly, the SAS were dropped in by Hercules.
While it was under occupation?
Either while it was under occupation or very early before, just before that. Again, that would be a matter of looking up the records and finding when they actually went in.
They were parachuted in, weren't they?
They were parachuted in, yeah.
That would be 70. Would it be 70? Or anyhow, you've got special forces.
That's right. I think it was the special forces, because after the war ended, a couple of the special forces guys got Air Force crosses or Distinguished Flying Crosses. One can only assume it was for the drops at that time.
Then there was the Vulcan that went down there to knock out the...
That's right.
Yeah.
But the main refueling in those days was done by the Victors, because obviously they were already established and they came down. It wasn't until sometime later that it was decided that we did not have enough tankers and that the Herc would be the ideal vehicle for the South Atlantic, as in fact has proven ever since. We're still operating Hercules tankers in the South Atlantic now, supporting the fighters.
From here, I mean, yeah. Yes, I see a number of aircraft flying around with the probes still on. I mean, they may not have the tanks inside, but presumably they've kept the probes on them.
All the aircraft are now probed for air to air.
Anyway.
Yes, right, for receiving. Yeah. We've now got 5 tankers left. Two are always in the MPA. Mm. And 3 of them are back here. There's usually one on a major servicing, either here or at Cambridge. And then 1 or 2 stay here to do UK tanking.
And are you still tanking now?
I'm still tanking now.
I have had this sequencing described to me by other Hercules crew members who were not on tankers. The very elaborate and complex system of getting from Ascension down to the Falklands, and the fact that tankers have got to feed tankers, they've got to feed more tankers, who feed the client aircraft, or whatever. Can you just, as far as you're concerned and your flying is concerned, you know, where you fitted into this pattern?
It changed as the system developed. In the early days, the criteria was always to give the aircraft that was going down to the Falklands enough fuel either to make Uruguay or Santiago in Chile, which was a long flight, having failed to get into the Falklands.
They had to go right around the bottom, I
suppose. Either right around the bottom or right around the outside of the Argentinian airspace and then into Uruguay. So the problems was to get down there with enough fuel. So in the early days, we used to take off, and it was cumbersome. We'd have a Victor refueling a Victor. The Victor would then go down with the Hercules tanker, or catch the Hercules tanker up, because the Hercules tanker had set off a long time ahead of that, obviously because of the incompatibility of speeds. The Victor would then refuel the Hercules tanker, who would then go on down the Atlantic and basically would be 9 hours out of Ascension Island when he refueled the Hercules freighter.
The customer.
That's right. So there were 3 tankers involved to get the Hercules tanker 9 hours down the route. Then the customer was refueled. He went on either to land at Stanley or to divert. Or, of course, the alternative, because it was so far down the leg at that stage, was that he had a last point of diversion and he could actually get all the way back to Ascension Island, if necessary. And some of them did do that. I think, in fact, when Mrs. Thatcher went down, she turned back and went back to Ascension Island on her first attempt. So she had a long time in the air without ever achieving her aim. If it wasn't Mrs. Thatcher, it was someone of cabinet rank. The tanker would then, having refueled his customer, would then return to Ascension Island.
Hercules tanker.
That's right. The Victors were already back by then.
Yeah.
So the first Victor would fly for about 3 hours. The second Victor would fly for about 6 hours. The Hercules tanker would fly for 17 and a half hours. One crew, and the freighter, assuming that he got into Stanley, would fly for 13 hours. If he didn't get into Stanley, he would also fly for about 17 hours. So it was a long, long day and quite dramatic. Bearing in mind that the Hercules crews had never done air-to-air refueling before, it was all set up very, very quickly. with really Heath Robinson equipment, which was developed as the situation progressed. And in fact, the same equipment, which was really is homemade, is still what's in the aircraft now. And it's been very effective. It's been a credit to the engineers who actually put it together.
Was that Marshall's?
Well, no, it was Royal Air Force initially.
Oh, on the base, yeah.
The tank, well, and around the Air Force generally. The tanks we use are old Andover long-range flyaway tanks. The collector box which we use in the centre, because the system is quite strange, we don't actually give fuel out of the rear tanks to the aircraft behind us. We give them our flying fuel, and then we refuel ourselves from the tanks inside the aircraft.
Why is that?
Mainly the complication of pumping and fitting in the various pipework. And in the early stages, it was decided that was by far the easiest way to do it. So obviously the limitation was that you could never give the customer too much fuel if the pumping system from the back failed. But it worked. It was quite hairy. It just so happened that inevitably, wherever we decided to put our refueling zones, we seemed to be in the weather. We'd fly for hours in beautiful, clear conditions to make a point, and that point, inevitably, there was cloud. But it made it that much more exciting. And the flying abilities of the Herculeat, I think, developed very, very fast. Certainly the close formation abilities developed very fast. Eventually, it was as the Victors became less and less available, the tanking was refined. We eventually went down to one Victor and one Hercules. And then, as the political situation also improved, and it was easier to go into Brazil or into Uruguay, we went down to one Hercules tanker and one freighter. The Hercules tanker would fly for about 6 hours out of Ascension Island, refuel the freighter, and the freighter would go on. And that's how it ended up on the airbridge situation, until the airbridges were stopped, and we now fly through Brazil.
What is the tank layout in a Hercules tanker?
The freight bay, basically, has been taken over by four Andover long-range tanks, situated centrally between the four tanks is a large collector box. The fuel comes out of the tanks, into the collector box, and is then pumped, originally by a Lynx fuel pump, which is virtually a vacuum cleaner pump. It was pumped up into our own wing tanks. Behind the tanks, on the ramp, is the Hoodoo, which is the hose drum unit. And those were recovered from all over the world, including one from an old Victor, which we'd given to the Americans for a museum. That hose reel has got the hose which extends out of the aircraft when we set up for tanking to refuel the customer behind us.
And then you've got your external tanks, which every Herc has anyway.
Well, that's just normal tankage, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And then the control panels are above the navigator's head on the flight deck.